Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown.
Where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and a culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
The tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 23 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom and
Vera Grubbs,
bringing you another fine show this morning.
Today is Groundhog Day, and we would be remiss if we didn't weigh in. Since February is also the month of love and romance, we have some appropriate poetry from our own Rick Fettig. We also have a couple of interviews with local musicians Robbie Bowden and artist Michelle Pollock. More discussion on the forest plan with Charlie Cole, another installment of The Lore of the Land with Bill Land, an essay from Dave Seastrom, and some poetry from Gunter Flum, Tramp Star, and Chris Curtin.
Here in our first segment is Rick Fettig, Robbie Bowden, Charlie Cole, Tramp Star, and Brown County's take on Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day. Every year on this day, the famous groundhog, Punxsutawney Phil, is brought out of his den by a man in formal dress wearing white gloves and a top hat to add his two cents to the age-old question, how much longer will winter last? The press gathers and pictures are snapped as this seemingly docile groundhog is displayed before the world and held forth to see or not see his shadow. While I'm sure this privileged rodent possesses all of the psychic skills every groundhog is said to have, here in Brown County, we think of them differently. First of all, our groundhogs live in the ground. They're not some pampered media contrivance with their coat all brushed and shiny, and they don't have their own personal butler to carry them around. They're critters in their own right, just like all the rest of the critters that inhabit the woods. Our groundhogs do not seek fame or fortune. They're quiet and reserved. All they want is a full belly and a nice den to ride out the winter. The last thing in the world they're interested in is having someone dig them out of their den and hold their freezing, sleepy self to the light of day so that the humans can figure out how long the winter is going to last. Without making too big a point of it, our groundhogs don't really care one whit about how much winter is left in the season. They are more than willing to let the humans worry about such nonsense without getting personally involved. For all the fuss their kinfolk generate, our groundhogs mind their own business and keep to themselves the way a proper groundhog should. While others of their ilk are strutting before the cameras, they are quietly sleeping out the winter, content to be in their dens no matter how long it takes until spring arrives. If Brown County had their own groundhog mascot, Brown County Bob and Punxsutawney Phil would have little in common. The fact is, Brown County Bob is in total hibernation, and he ain't never gonna see his shadow in the middle of the winter. After all, he's far more concerned about ending up in the stew pot than whether or not he can see his shadow. This is Dave Seastrom.
Who can I let hold this heart of mine, which is the last true resource of myself? Who could have the strength to carry the weight, or the tenderness to carry its palpitating moods and methods? Who is there that I can turn to? Who is there that I can reach out to? Who is there that I can talk to and share the innermost sentiments of this heart? Who could it be? And when will I know her? I don't want to suppress my ever-flowing emotions and desires. I want to care and share and give and live the greatness of life. I want my love to compound moment by moment and hour by hour as one giving effort enhances another and another until such a thing as karma bubbles with the excitement and enthusiasm of selfless service in pure, unadulterated love.
A Hello, this is Dave Seastrin.
And I'm Rick Fettig.
With the Brown County Hour, this evening we're interviewing Brown County legend Robbie Bowden. Robbie, glad to have you in the studio.
Well, thanks, guys.
It's a great privilege.
Well, from 1972, when the string band got going, you guys were mostly playing for beers, but it evolved into this whole huge experience. You want to elaborate on that?
We were playing what was then called the Old Hickory Inn, which is now Out of the Ordinary in downtown Nashville, across from the Playhouse. We had a couple of nights a week that we did there, and we packed the place. So people were snake dancing, and it was really fun. A friend of ours who lived here in the community at the time had a friend in Indianapolis who was a booking agent, had a booking agency, and he said, I can get this guy down here. And it took about a month for him to get down. As soon as he heard us, he said, I can book these guys. And so he did. He booked us in the supper clubs and the steakhouses in Indianapolis, a couple of college gigs. He shut down the booking agency and went on the road with us as a road manager. He hooked us up with two booking agents out of Chicago and Minneapolis.
Wow.
And we played all over the Great Lakes states and the Great Plains states, anything east of the Rockies. And we were on the road for 4 years.
Jeez. Nice.
How'd you travel?
We had a box van.
Like an old Econoline?
Yeah, it was just a van with a box on the back, and we put our stuff in the back of the van, and we had this old couch that we put in front of the stuff, and whoever wasn't sitting up front driving or on the passenger seat, we sat on the couch, and Scott Mary, the banjo player, he had a hammock stretched across the equipment in the back. And we drove through blizzards and snow things that people died in.
Yeah.
You know, in North Dakota, Minnesota. It was incredible.
Mercy. But you ended up in California doing a lot of recording.
Yes, we did. Friend of ours, Bruce McConnell, paid for the whole thing, took us out west, and we got into Indigo Ranch Studio. Our engineer was Bob Margalef, who was quite well known in the, he did some work with Stevie Wonder, and also Richard Kaplan. It was a great experience. We recorded almost 20 songs, I think, and did a 10-song album.
Who was in that band?
Okay, Dave Gore, Paul Pell, Kenny Aprilla, and I started the band. You'll hear it on the Cripple Creek song. And then Paul left the band. We got Scott Mary on bass and banjo and bass. And we picked up Art Nash on drums, who was with Mason Prophet, who was quite a successful band. On,
yeah, local band.
Yeah out of Indianapolis, and they ended up on Warner Brothers Records. Art joined the band. Bob Lucas joined us later on. Jim Moore on steel guitar. John Rao was with us for a while out of Indianapolis. He took Dave's place on guitar. So the finishing band was actually a couple of guys from Minneapolis that had worked with Mason Prophet that Art had brought in. Kinky and Creeper were their names.
They brought in some gunslingers?
Oh, they had keyboards and harmonica and lead guitar, and that was the last episode that we had, November and December of 77.
Well, what happened to that recording?
I have some, and Kenny has them too. We were called Buck Dancer at that time. Somebody in California didn't like the name String Bean String Band. They thought it was hokey. So we came up with Buck Dancer, which was a street dancer post-Civil War days in the South.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. String Bean String Band sounds so friendly to me.
I know. I wasn't real happy with the fact that we had to change our name, but that was Bob Margalef's idea.
Sounds like showbiz.
Yeah, exactly. It was very L.A.
Well, at least they didn't turn you into Johnny Cougar.
No. No, we still looked like we looked like, and we acted like we acted like. After that, I was with a band called Survivors. With Jim Moore, who was with us in the last days, and did all those recordings in California with us. And we went out to Arizona, and I stayed there for 9 years. I was the last one to leave, and I worked with some really great folks. Bob Henke, who was with Goose Creek Symphony, Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. He co-produced some of their recordings, you know, When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman and Sexy Eyes. And I worked with a group in Ohio for a while, and then we moved back here. Then we formed the Longshot Band with Stephanie Cooper, who I still work with to this day. She's a great singer and a great stage presence. And I do a lot of solo work and that kind of stuff.
Well, you've had a long association with Brown County. You're in fact, a native Brown Countyan.
I am. I'm fourth generation Brown County.
Oh, man. There you go. That passes for royalty around here.
My great-grandfather came here from England in the 1850s.
Oh, my goodness.
James Joshua. Yeah.
So what is it about Brown County? You had the opportunity, you saw the world, you traveled, you lived in lots of different places, and here you are again.
Because I like it. This is my home. You know, I saw what I had to see, and I came back, and this is my roots, my nest, my family is close by. I'm so glad to be back here.
And we're glad to have you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, Robbie, what are you up to now?
Well, I'm doing a lot of solo work, playing around town. But I work with a lady that I've been with from the Longshot Band about 13, 14 years ago. We started singing together, and we do a duo, which I think is really neat. And sometimes Dave Gore joins us, you know, when we do the Playhouse or something special.
He's a great guitar player, too.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got that high tenor voice, you know, that we started singing together in high school.
Oh, my.
That was just Dave Gore and Robbie Bowden. We just did it a cappella before either one of us learned how to play guitar.
Did you get any of that on tape?
No, I don't think we ever did. I think somebody commented one time walking down the street here and Dave and I singing and said, "You guys sound like a couple of howling dogs." This was the early 60s. I mean, you know, he was a sophomore in high school. I was a senior in high school. And we started singing together. His brother had a songbook and some recordings, and we, you know, old country stuff.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing a solo, but I'm also working with a lady named Stephanie Cooper. She's like a sister to me. We've been singing together for all 13, 14 years. We're called the Vocal Yokels, and we sing around town in some venues outside of town. She grew up in Morgantown. She lives outside of Trafalgar. She works for an investment company out of Columbus. She's just the best. She's one of my best friends. She and I are working on a CD that should be out in the spring.
Do you have a working title?
Yes, Vocal Yokels Covers and Quilts.
Nice.
Because we're doing all covers. We don't do any original stuff. We just do covers of classic country, classic pop, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Stephanie and I are going great guns. I love working with her. And then Dave Gore joins us on occasion. You can catch us on Facebook, Vocal Yokels, and it has pictures in it, schedules, and so on and so forth. I'll be playing solo in February. Check the Our Brown County magazine or whatever.
So, Robbie, let's get to some music. Tell us about our first song we're going to hear.
Okay, this is an old traditional instrumental called Up on Cripple Creek. It was recorded at the Ordinary, which was called the Old Hickory Inn. This was the original four, Paul Pell, Dave Gore, Kenny Aprilla, and myself. And it's just good old foot stomping stuff. This is what started the band.
3, 4. Going in a run, going up the Cripple Creek, you have some fun. Going up the Cripple Creek, going in a whirl. Going up the Cripple Creek, you see my girl. Thank you.
Thank you. God love you.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, and it's my pleasure to introduce Charlie Cole, who's going to speak to us about the forest situation in Brown County.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Charlie.
When we last talked, I believe we left the history at about 1940. During the 1940s, the Yellowwood authorities deemed healing the land the main priority. At that time, you could see the scars from the ridgetops in a dendritic pattern on aerial photo maps. They planted red pines, they planted white pines. They built a CCC, built a road, the straight road that goes past the forest headquarters. Of course, they made the lake, and they built two buildings, the assistant manager's residence and the shelter house. Things pretty much went undisturbed until 1964, when the DNR began a regular practice of timbering. Over the years, up until 2004, they were taking an average of 17% of the growth in board feet for every unit area that they cut. The 1990s were notable for two reasons. Number one, the lake started silting, and Yellowwood Lake ended up in 2005 having 22 acres silted in into wetlands. The other thing that was notable in the early 1990s were the best management practices were invented, commonly known as BMPs, by a committee which included a local environmentalist, Andy Mahler, and among other people, a very, very competent forester named William Foley, who ran a mill north of Nashville. In the late 1990s, Bernie Fisher, the head forester of the Division of Forestry, introduced a series of stakeholder input workshops. And these were designed to get stakeholder input and to come up with common solutions, rules for fair fighting. The group operated by consensus. And there were many partners along the way. The main people in the watershed group represented were the Hoosier Flycasters, the Hoosier Trail Riders, the Nature Conservancy, the DNR, Friends of Yellowwood, and local neighbors. The deliverables from the Yellowwood Watershed Group were many. A state-of-the-art horse trail with very little erosion potential. The Hoosier Flycasters won a national award for their mapping of the silt in the lake. Very interesting bunch of people. They're mostly retired suits, and I've never heard such true after-dinner conversation in my life. Some of the deliverables from the Watershed Group were we did River Watch, we did two Forested Watershed Conferences, we produced a newsletter, and we did a GIS system for all the research that is being done in the watershed. We corroborated all the different research into one computer program with overlays so that, for example, if you were comparing tree cover to soil type, you could do that with this particular invention. As part of their deliverables, the Yellowwood Watershed Group in roughly 2000, 2001, somewhere in there, they did a model logging cut and an interpretive trail. The group at that time included two members of the timber industry, a member of the Small Woodlot Owners Association and a local timber cutter. And the group came up with a scheme that basically mirrored the state's 17% average. It was like 14 or 15%, and it was marked and cleared, and brochures were prepared. In 2004, Mitch Daniels was elected, and at that time, the Forest Alliance, which is basically a bunch of college-age kids in Bloomington, started to get interested in state forest issues. So Mitch Daniels and his legislature made the DNR exempt from environmental impact statements, IEPAs. What that meant was that there was no oversight over them from that point on.
Hi, I'm Tramp Star. You don't know about me without you've read the writings of a fellow named Carl Wilson, but that ain't no matter. Carl was a writer, a goat farmer, a boxer, and an all-around swell guy. Good friend of mine. Carl used to publish some of my stuff under the title Jokes and Jingles from Curly Shingles by Tramp Star. Curly Shingles was the name he had given his little old cabin. The shake shingles had all kind of curled up on him. Tramp Star is, well, that's me. Obituary. I've heard a dozen folks relate the story of Bill Turnip's fate, a man who sat still 20 years and then lit in to vegetate. Born, lived, and died in old Moore's Hill, got plenty turnips down here still. Blood kin that knowed Bill's story well and's never lied and never will. Weren't nothing wrong with Bill nowhere, diseases or things like that there, to make him want to spend his days reclining in a rocking chair. plumb laziness, and nothing more was what the neighbors said, and swore that if they was his hard-working wife, they'd up and kick him out the door. But her, she lugged in all the coal, and fed him victuals from a bowl, and got along the best she could, a patient, philosophic soul. Yep, waited on him, heat and snow, for 20 weary years or so, with him not moving hand or foot, outside a rocking to and fro. But towards the end, as kinfolk say, he put that exercise away, and from then on, he never budged. Just sat there, like a lump of clay. Doc Cutter, young Doc's dad, he's dead these many years. He shook his head and spoke up plain for all to hear. He'll turn to vegetable, he said. And Doc was right. Bill tasseled out and started in to grow and sprout. His head turned to a Hubbard squash, his hair to wavy sauerkraut. Bananas formed his hands, his feet was watermelon, striped and neat. His arms and legs was roasting ears, his nose a large and rosy beet. His cheeks was tender cabbage buds, and when they looked beneath his duds, they found his torso was composed completely of Green Mountain spuds. Bill's wife, in her new widowhood, twisted her apron where she stood, and then spoke up in trembling tones. I never saw Bill look so good. She stooped and smoothed his sauerkraut and straightened his bananas out and give his melons both a thump to see if they was right, no doubt. Well, that's the story as they tell her. Not a whimper, not a beller. Went and got a bushel basket, toted Bill down to the cellar. Dozen neighbors heard her say, Lord gives and he takes away. My Bill will come in mighty fine with fresh pork come hog killing day.
We'll be right back after station identification.
Feel nurtured and encouraged as you begin or continue your yoga practice. Riverlight Yoga is Nashville, Indiana's only dedicated yoga space committed to your personal growth and healthy yoga practice. See riverlightyoga.com for full details.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org.
Welcome back to episode 23 of the Brown County Hour. In our next segment, we have an essay from Dave Seastrom, more music from Robbie Bowden, an interview with artist Michelle Pollock, Tales from the Planet Earth with Bill Land, and a poem from Gunter Flum.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. In many ways, Brown County is a timeless place. The hills and the ravines haven't changed much since the last ice age. The sky is still blue, and the streams still run. Even the uneducated eye can look at our forest lands and have a sense of what the land was like in the beginning, full and lush and teeming with wildlife. The occasional native hunting party that made their way through here took what they needed and moved on with little, if any, impact. And this was the story for thousands of years. But change is as sure as the dawning of a new day. And when one culture displaced the other, the white settlers who moved here were mostly farmers. Many of them were veterans who had been given land in acknowledgement of their service. It's curious to think of Brown County as farmland, and a suitable reward for a veteran farmer and his family. I have a feeling that more than a few of these farmers took a look at what they found and said, where is the farmland? And moved on. Not that there aren't a few valley patches where crops could grow, and still do. But the county was covered with virgin forest, trees of unimaginable size, and terrain so rough farming isn't the first thing that comes to mind. There was almost no way for a small farmer to move these behemoths, so they burnt them as they cleared the hills to make their tiny farms. I recall a conversation I had in the mid-70s with a much older gal who remembered her grandfather talking about clearing a field of black walnut. He was a young boy at the time, but every hand was needed, and the family worked for weeks and weeks. There was no such thing as chainsaws or two-man crosscut saws. Those would come later. They chopped those trees down with axes, and they rived what they needed into boards with wedges. When enough wood was collected to construct a shelter for themselves and their animals, the remaining walnuts were sectioned into pieces small enough to be skidded by the horses and pulled into the middle of what became their field. We're talking about trees that were 4 to 8 feet thick. In recounting the family lore, the fire took most of 2 weeks, and the ash became the fertilizer for the first crops that they grew. When more settlers came, this story was repeated many times, until the forest had most of its ridgetops and wide valleys cleared and burnt for homesteads. As slash and burn farming spread, the inevitable truth of this practice produced less and less fertile ground, and the farms they made were barely able to feed them. At this point, there was still a seemingly inexhaustible forest they could draw from, and the wildlife that lived there offered plenty of sustenance. No one knew it at the time, but nature was already out of balance and sliding towards its inevitable collapse. By the turn of the 20th century, in a span of less than 80 years from settlement, all of the large game in the forest was gone. It was about that time that the railroad made it all the way to Helmsburg and the logging industry was born. Almost everyone in the county was employed by the sawmills or logging, and forest removal began in earnest. In its heyday, there were several mills in Helmsburg, and forest products left the county on the many trains that existed for this purpose. The work was finished just in time for the Great Depression. Once the clear cut was completed, the mills shut down, and there were no jobs or game, and their hilltops farm became part of the worst erosion this county has seen since the Ice Age. The consequence was a massive migration out of the county, a migration so profound that it took until the late 70s to recover. This is a sad story of unintended mismanagement. No one saw the big picture or thought of the consequences of their actions. Nature was allowed to return as the result of benign neglect. And almost 100 years later, we live in this recovered forest land that once again is teeming with wildlife and large game. The question we need to ask ourselves is, have we learned anything from this tragedy? And friends, the jury is out. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. See you next time. We're back with Robbie Bowden. So Robbie, tell us about this next piece, Sail On.
Okay, Kenny Iaparella and I, the original fiddle player, mandolin player, and later on lead and steel player, we wrote this song, and Vicki Helber, who was very active in the music scene in those days, in the 70s, who still lives in Bloomington, she approached us and said, I have been approached by the Bloomington sampler people to put together a sampler of Bloomington music. She said, I'd like to do Sail On with you guys and sing the lead on it. And so we did. And we went into Jack Guilfoyle's studio and we put this down. I think it's one of the best recordings we ever did. It just was magic. Vicki did a great job, and I think everybody did a great job on the tracks.
could I do to make you happy? What can I say to make you smile? This song is something that I have. Chase away the madness for a while.
This is Vera Grutz with the Brown County Hour for WFHB, and I have with me today Michelle Pollack. How are you today, Michelle?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Okay. I know you as a paper artist.
Yes.
And it's a very unique art. You're going to have to explain it to me. I'm not sure exactly what it is you do.
I do stitched paperwork and three-dimensional, what I call paper sculptures. The stitched paper, I basically cut out pieces of paper similar to the way quilters do applique. I layer them up and then I stitch them either by hand or with the sewing machine. And the three-dimensional paper sculptures came out of my bookbinding training. I essentially took pop-up book techniques, so book pop-ups, and I build them into shadow boxes. By putting them in the shadow boxes, it gives me a lot more flexibility to add items to the shadow box that you wouldn't be able to put in a pop-up book. And I also hand bind books.
So you make a book?
Yes, I hand bind books from scratch. I start with the book binding board, which is like a really dense archival cardboard. I make the artwork for the front. I cover the boards for the covers. I use text weight paper, which I fold and cut to the right size and shape, and then I hand stitch the books together. And mostly they're blank books and journals that I sell at art fairs and in galleries. I've had poetry published in numerous journals around the country, literary journals, and I've had two chapbooks published. But mostly now the poetry I write ends up in my artwork somehow. I kind of do it as a joint thing with the visual artwork.
And what made you choose Brown County to put down some roots for a while?
I grew up in Lake County, Indiana, northern Indiana, and there. I spent at least once a year, spent a long weekend in Brown County State Park because we camped when I was growing up. That was our vacations. And my parents really liked Brown County State Park for obvious reasons. And I was 10 years old when I fell in love with this part of Indiana. And after my husband and I decided we were going to leave Minnesota, he had never been here before. And I told him how wonderful it was here. And he came down and looked at it with me. We both love it. And we found a wonderful house. And we're very happy to be here.
Another fairy tale story.
It is. There's a lot of them around, aren't there?
Yes.
A lot of my work has birds and trees and leaves and nature in it. And before I moved here, I never did nature art. And yeah. I think it's just being surrounded by it. You can't help it. It's, yeah. you know, my style that's so well known around here, but it's still, you can't help but being inspired by the beautiful countryside we have here.
Do you have a website?
I do have a website. I have two ways people can see my work online. The website is LostLakeStudio.com, and then the other places I have a Facebook page, which is Facebook/LostLakeStudio, and there's images of my work, and there's information about my studio, and that's always a good place to start when you want to see what people are up to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you coming in, Michelle.
Well, I appreciate being here. It was very fun.
This has been Vera Grubbs for the Brown County Hour and WFHB.
This is Bill Land, the land and the lore of Brown County. During the beautiful Brown County winter season, it makes me think of how resourceful and self-reliant most folks are in Brown County. Big wood piles everywhere. They do things by the seat of their pants because they need to. Years ago, I taught a series of workshops for students from Indianapolis. It's called Visiting Planet Earth. Imagine you've landed in an environment that you might have to stay and occupy the rest of your life. Luckily, this planet has the resources that could sustain life with proper management and skills. The walking tour of the different homesteads of Needmore Community, Northwest Brown County, started out with looking for the wild edible plants so we could have for dinner, a side dish, a salad. We went on to Susan's cabin and saw windows being made from scratch and cutting cabin logs, putting a noisy chainsaw in the hand of these students. This is the first time they ever had a chainsaw in their hands, and it's quite interesting. Learning from the midwife, she was there under the shade tree talking about how wonderful it was to have a newborn at home, safe and sound. That was so cool that the baby would be born at home and not in a hospital. Just up the lake road, we went to my home there at Needmore, talked about not having any power. We had mineral spirits for lanterns at night, cooked on a wood stove. We had a real ice box. Went down to Old Helmsburg and got big blocks of ice and brought them back for our icebox. And a privy? Word privy. Think about this. It comes from the word privilege. I was just teasing you. But this privy had no door on one side, and we valued the look of the woodland instead of privacy. Milk in the show goat was really cool in the stainless steel bucket. There were rabbits for meat. Free-range chickens laying one egg a day per hen. That was very, very efficient, and just running around getting their grubs out there in the woodland. Organic gardens with wonderful goat compost. Back in, we had dinner. Dinner of rabbit noodles, goat cheese, green salad, milk grain bread with sassafras jelly. All of a sudden, there was a panic. One of the students said, "I went out to the privy with my flashlight, and there was a hen in the outhouse." We said, "Of course there's a hen in the outhouse. That's Mary. She's the oldest hen, and she likes to be in their company." "No," she says, the hen is down in the hole of the outhouse." "Oh, no. Let me get a hoe with a blade, and I'll lift Mary out." A little bit later, Mary came out, ruffled the feathers, smell and all, headed out to the woods to find a new roost. We went back to the Needmore Community Building, talked about legends of Brown County, banjo music, guitar music. We had a wonderful evening. But the legend that everybody liked, legend of Dove Bill. Now, Dove Bill, an Indian maiden, a Shawnee maiden, went right along Pine Bluff, which sits about 100 feet above the Bean Blossom Bottoms. And she used to put her baby in a sling. The wind would rock the baby back and forth, and the baby was so content. All of a sudden, one day, a big wind came up, and the baby disappeared. And you can still hear Dove Bill listening for the baby's cry. You can hear Dove Bill calling and calling and calling. She did this for months, and eventually Dove Bill also disappeared. So if you go to Pine Bluff in a moonlight night, you can hear in the breeze of the Canadian hemlocks, Dove Bill still calling for her missing child. Breakfast the next morning. Wild hickory pancakes. Scrambled eggs, duck eggs, of course, goat milk cheese, wild berry jam on fresh baked bread from Mill Green. The whole class hiked up to Pine Bluff, And as I heard as I came back, one student said, "This is the most unique weekend I have ever experienced. Never saw anything like it. I felt like I came from another planet. This is a very unusual place." And with that, we know how wonderful it is in Brown County. It is a different planet for a lot of us. It's a wonderful planet of self-reliance. This has been Bill Land.
A rodent, fat with brownish hair, portends our weather, some declare. Its shadow seen on Groundhog Day means spring is now 6 weeks away. And that's why here in our Brown County, on that day, there is a bounty on any varmint that is found that casts its shadow on the ground. For most folks here think that's the thing to end the winter and bring on spring. And so we form that day a rally to scour forests, hills, and valley to find them groundhogs in their hole and keep their shadows from the toll of making winter last too long, for we all know that it's all wrong to let some rodent that can gnaw to keep us from a winter's thaw. And so to help them hibernate, we hunt them critters on that date with trepidation and some fear that on that one day, once a year, its shadow means that we all know there's 6 more weeks of cold and snow. But if we find them out next day, we don't begrudge their shadow play, for we all know it's our tradition the next day there's no superstition that if their shadow hits the ground that winter somehow sticks around. And so we let them varmints be, since any shadow they might see don't mean that winter's gonna last, since Groundhog Day is gone and past. But this year we done got all wise and gave them critters a new disguise. For just so things don't stay the same, we gave them varmints another name, since any shadow cast its way might change. If it's called Woodchuck Day, it might work.
We'll be right back after station identification.
Feel nurtured and encouraged as you begin or continue your yoga practice. Riverlight Yoga is Nashville, Indiana's only dedicated yoga space committed to your personal growth and healthy yoga practice. See riverlightyoga.com for full details.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org. Welcome back to the final segment of Episode 23 of the Brown County Hour. In this segment, Rick Fettig shares the top 10 reasons to visit Brown County. We also have music from Robbie Bowden, more comments from Charlie Cole on the forest situation, and a timely love poem from Rick Fettig.
The top 10 reasons to visit Brown County. Number 10, there are many fine art galleries you can visit. Number 9, when you're here, you are surrounded by the beautiful landscape. Number 8, you're welcome to ride your motorcycle in town, unless it's too noisy. Number 7, you can still pee in your own yard unless they catch you and you get a fine. Number 6, it's easy to find a deer trail just about anywhere. Number 5, the state park is beautiful any time of the year. Number 4, there are plenty of rattlesnakes for everyone. Number 3, the shops have lots of arts and crafts to see. Number 2, if your kids get bored, they can ride the zip line. And number 1, if you come quickly, you can see the forest before it's cut down and Brown County becomes truly brown. This is Rick Fettig. Come on down to Brown County.
This is Chris Curtin with a poem called Stolen Secrets. Moonlight steals into the forest like a cat burglar prowling through the disordered architecture of the darkness. Subtly shifting surfaces, slowly searching shadows, its gaze sweeping side to side in its noiseless, persistent pursuit, stealthily stalking whatever it can uncover with its dim, determined light, preserving appearances on the threshold of disappearance. A surreptitious emissary of the night's necessities, soliciting essential simulations, processing necessary illusions, sifting through shimmering sorrows, stripping away hidden miseries, shivering shapes scattering messages, scooping up glistening treasures, seizing all the valuables in sight, disappearing before dawn with stolen secrets it will never share, slipping away silently as the morning mist administers its magic.
We're back with Robbie Bowden. Robbie, I guess Henry was a country boy?
Yes. I met him when he was 82, and he started coming to our gigs. Slats Klug and I were playing a gig in Bedford outside at a winery. He came in with a couple of his granddaughters, and from that point, his whole family came to see us play. Slats and I and Mike Moody, we had a trio for a while. I played his 83rd birthday. I was living in Indianapolis at the time. Henry had passed away, and somebody called me and said, Henry's gone. And somewhere within the next couple of weeks, I wrote this song for Henry, and I gave it to his family. I think it's one of the best things I've ever written. Henry was a country boy.
Looking back on a special life, so many sights and sounds, the father, children, and the wife, their history turns around. And in these times there is a heart in a family's loving place, the natural shining in their lives comes from a living grace. Henry was a country boy. He sang the old songs. We played Hank and Willie's stories of love gone wrong. He'd say, son, do you remember the one about the girl who got away? We'd talk about our favorite singers and the ones who are still with us today. A wonderful soul, gave his loved ones joy. My friend, that country boy. And so we pray he rests in peace, hears the angels sing of country roads that lead back home and warming breezes in the spring. A gentle soul, he filled our lives with joy. Always love him, our country boy. God bless our dear country boy.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour.
And Rick Fettig, and we'd like to thank Robbie Bowden for coming in here. It's been a great pleasure, and we always enjoy your company and your music.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, guys. Thank you, everybody.
Now back with our Woodwatch interview with Charlie Cole.
Roughly the same time, a Forest Lions member, who we all know, Forrest Grass, was turning in site violations at the logging sites. Immediately afterward, it was announced that there was to be a ban on traffic within 200 feet of the logging site, within 200 feet of the entrance to the road entering the logging site. This was done to keep Forrest from turning them in. Andy Mahler says that there has been an increase of almost 1,000% in the logging since 2002. The Daniels administration is not cutting 17% of the growth in board feet. They're cutting over 60%. They had originally tried for 80%, but the green certification group that they used, which was industry friendly, said that even they couldn't do 80%, that 60% was as much as they could cut, which meant if they cut 60%, then the forest is only growing 2/5 as much as it should under natural circumstances.
Charlie, when you have 60%, that's 60% of all mature timber. We're talking about every tree in the forest that is 16 inches or larger. Is that correct?
Yes. The math gets a little more strange. I'll get to that in a moment. But that is essentially correct, David. Yes. In 2001, the Watershed Group commissioned a study funded partly by IDEM and the Federal Department of Agriculture. We had a lot of help from different government agencies. The result of this study was an engineering report by Stantec Engineering of Louisville, Kentucky, examining both erosion hotspots in the area and also examining the road condition. One of the observable facts that they pointed out was that silt, which was product of erosion, was in the creek corridors. It had previously been on the top of the hills and washed down next to the creeks. Every time a large major water event happened, more of this was deposited in Yellowwood Lake. It was estimated that thousands of tons on every major water event flowed into Yellowwood Lake.
I want to make one point clear, though. I think for a lot of people it's hard to imagine when we talk about 60%, what's really going to be left are only young trees. The actual older growth forest that we have known for all these years will be replaced by an entirely young forest. The state has seen nothing like this since the original clear cut in the early 30s. Is this correct?
It's pretty bad. The problem with their cutting is that they're looking at one point in time. And if you consider the invasion of alien species and the subsequent decimation of different parts of the tree population, their math gets a little scary. For example, invasive species. Sudden oak death was reported at a nursery in Indiana before the Mitch Daniels administration, and the previous state head forester had stated that the two most important problems facing the DNR in the future were lack of habitat and invasion of alien species. So sudden oak death affects more than 20 different species of trees and shrubs, including oaks. And then there's the new one that's in the area. It's in Tennessee, but if you have walnuts in this area, you probably have it already. It takes years for it to kill a walnut tree, but 1,000 canker disease for walnuts. Also, before this current administration was elected, they found invasive beetles called Asian longhorn beetles in pallets from Asia in Indianapolis, and the ones that they found were dead. But in places very close to here, like Chicago, they have had to clear cut entire forests to stop this pest, which affects, let's see, maples, willows, poplars, goes on and on. The problem with their logging scheme is that instead of going in once every 20 years and getting 17%, they're going in sometimes four, five, six times in 20 years to get 60%. And every time that they reopen one of these cuts, it makes a highway for invasive species. Invasive species thrive in disturbed environments. For example, it is very possible that some of these invasive species are being carried by long-haul trucks, taking wood from Yellowwood Forest to other parts in the state. Most of the wood sold in the state forest goes to three or four different companies, all of which are fairly far away. So new BMPs might be needed, steaming the trucks down at both destinations, perhaps even making the logging available only to people within the invasive area, such as we have with the Emerald Ash Borer. You're not allowed to take wood outside a certain area.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. Our state forest lands in Brown and several other counties are about to undergo a dramatic change. The DNR's new forest management plan will eliminate the three remaining backcountry preserve areas that have been protected since Doc Bowen was governor. and every single parcel will experience a 400% increase in logging. 30-foot-wide gravel roads will be carved throughout the forest in order to facilitate this increase. What this means, in practical terms, is the complete loss of all wildlands in our state forests, something that hasn't happened since the massive clear-cut 100 years ago. Let me say this another way. We will see a complete change to the character and integrity of our forest. Once the plan is completed, there will no longer be any unbroken forest lands, and 60% of all the trees currently standing will be hauled out of here with a drastic effect on wildlife, the watershed, and the local tourist industry. Right now, there are bills before the House and Senate of Indiana that would return the protected status of the three remaining outback areas. Both Senator Steele and Representative Koch will be attending the League of Women Voters meeting on February the 8th at 10 a.m. at the County Office Building in Nashville. If you think about it, with half of our lands in public domain, who has more skin in the game than Brown County? If this concerns you, if you would like your children and your grandchildren to be able to experience undisturbed old-growth forest lands, please consider attending this meeting to share your views with our representative. Time is running out. For more information, you can go to our website at www.browncountyhour.com. This is Dave Seaston with the Brown County Hour. Thank you for your concern.
This is Rick Fettig, and I had a dream. Two friends walking, two friends talking, hand in hand and eye to eye. Two friends serving to build community, two friends working to build the future, two friends standing for what is right. Two friends looking toward the future, two friends' vision for what could be, two friends hoping for good for all. Two friends smiling and lifting each other, two friends touching and healing each other, two friends sharing and caring and loving and moving together day by day, week by week, years upon years, through moments, though moment by moment. Two friends walking.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 23 of the Brown County Hour, broadcast from WFHB the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m.
You can stream this or any of our shows at our website, browncountyhour.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out our new page, Woodwatch, which is devoted to all things pertaining to the situation our forest lands are facing. And be sure to visit us on Facebook.
This show was produced by Jeff Foster and Pam Rader and co-produced by Rick Fettig, Vera Grubbs, and Dave Seastrom. The executive producer is Allison Bechtesh for WFHB. We also wish to thank Slats Klug for our theme music. Way to go, buddy!
You've been listening to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County. Oh.